So with regard to what takes place in Beshalach, specifically the Shira, the Kriyas Yamsuf, you have the Kriyas Yamsuf, and then you have the Shira. There are a lot of issues that one can question. For example, the Mitzrayim chase after the Jews, and it would seem that when the Jews left Egypt, it says but they went beyond Ramah. The pasuk points that out, that they did not sneak out like thieves in the night, but they were organized, unified, and they took weapons with them, and they were with a certain type of a banner, a certain type of a pride, a certain type of a strength. And then, when the Egyptians chased after them, it seems that they completely collapsed, completely fell apart. And Moshe told them that God will fight for you. So, of course, the question arises, why weren't the Jews obliged to fight for themselves at that point? In general, the Judaism is not pacifistic. The Torah maintains that there's such a thing as war. There's an obligatory war. There's an optional war, Milchemes Rishus. But when you're attacked, you're obligated to fight back. That's an obligation. And yet, in this particular case, Moshe said, God will fight for you. It's also interesting that only a few weeks after that, they're attacked by Amalek, and there's a completely different response. Then Moshe tells Yoshua to choose men and wage a war, which seems to be the classical response. But why was that case different? Why didn't Moshe say that God will fight for you in that case? What's the reason for the disparity? Also, with regard to the issue of the Shira, there are some questions. The question is, why did they compose the Shira? The Shira is a very exalted form of praise. We recite the Shira every day. Why specifically with regard to this miracle and not other miracles? Well, true, it was a great miracle. True, it was the destruction of the Egyptian army. But there were other great miracles. The miracles of the man, the miracle of the bear, the miracle of Sinai, and so forth. So what was so special and unique about it? I would raise the question that the subject matter, the theme of the Shira, seems to be extolling God as Ishmael Chama, in God's capacity, so to speak, as a warrior. And on the surface, it seems that one could raise a question, that we don't have a tradition, a military tradition, to extol military victory. Even though we've produced great warriors like David HaMelech, but that's clearly not the essence. We're different than other societies that glorify war and conquest. To the contrary, we're all familiar with the Chazal that says that that the Mizbeach, you can't use a sword in the construction of the Mizbeach. Ki charbecha heinafta aleha v'atachaleha. The sword is associated with human conquest, and something which destroys life. It shortens the life of man, and the Mizbeach lengthens the days of man, and so forth. So while we recognize that we're obligated to fight, certainly the attitude seems to be that it's not an ideal. It's, so to speak, a necessary evil. In fact, there is an ambivalence with regard to the Shira, as we know that Chazal say that the Malachi Hasharis wanted to sing Shira. And God rebuked them and said that the works of my hand are drowning in the sea, and you want to say Shira? So, of course, that raises another question. So either or, so to speak. So does that mean that it's wrong? That even though the Egyptians were destroyed, even though the wicked were destroyed, but to the extent that they are the works of God's hands, God's creations, to that extent there's nothing to be happy about, so then it would seem that it's wrong to sing Shira. So if that's the case, then why were the Jews not rebuked? And if the Jews are correct in singing Shira, of course the wicked were destroyed, so then why were the Malachi Hasharis rebuked? These are some of the questions that pertain to the Shira itself. To try and approach these questions, we have to go back to the events that occurred immediately before the Kriyas Yamsuf. That is, after the Jews left Mitzrayim, so it says that God didn't take them by the straight path, which would have led them into Eretz Yisrael very quickly, the way of the Pelishtim, but rather in a circuitous path. Then, in Perek Yedaled, so God tells Moshe to tell the Bnei Yisrael to return and to encamp in front of Pi Hachiros, between Migdol and the Yam, before Baal Tzifon. They should encamp by the sea. Now this was a ruse, deception, to create a deception so that Paro will say that they're confused and they've become disoriented. They've lost their way in the Midbar. And in addition, God will harden Paro's heart. Because after everything that he'd gone through, been through, it's hard for us to imagine how we wouldn't let them go. Be happy to be rid of them already. So it requires a tremendous hardening of the heart to enable them to chase after them. And God will be glorified through Paro. Rashi says, when the wicked are destroyed, so God's name is magnified. That's a very important idea. Because to the extent that the wicked are successful and triumphant, so this is a Chil Hashem. Because then people are drawn after them. And people say that that's all that there is. That there is no God behind the universe. And the only thing that matters is physical might, is human might, and that's the deification of man. As long as the wicked are successful, so people are totally demoralized, and they're drawn after them. But when the wicked are destroyed, then people see that it's false. That no matter how powerful you are from a physical standpoint, it doesn't matter. Because the ultimate reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's the program, that's the point. The point of this is to create the Kiddush Hashem by the destruction of Paro. That pasuk ends, that's pasuk Dalet, Vayasu Chein. Now the words Vayasu Chein are significant. It's basically telling you that the Jews did as they were instructed. But one would ask, there's no real need to point it out. What's the point of mentioning that? So Rashi comments. Rashi says, Lahaget Shifchon, to praise them, to tell you their praise. Sheshamu l'kol Moshe, that they listened to the voice of Moshe. V'lo amru, heich niskarev el rodfenu. And they didn't say, how can we draw closer to our pursuers? Anu tzrichim levroach. We really have to run away. Ela amru, ein lanu ela divrei ben Amram. But they said, all we have are the words of Ben Amram. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's very significant. That is to say that at this point in time, they were apparently on a high level. Because clearly, from an emotional standpoint, what Moshe was telling them to do would be something very dangerous. A person's running away, he wants to escape, the natural inclination is to keep going forward. Certainly not to go back and make yourself more vulnerable. But nevertheless, they had reached a level where they weren't functioning according to these emotions. They used their intelligence. And they recognized that everything that happened was because of the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's what they had to operate by. So that was their praise. So they went back. Then, of course, the story continues with Melech Mitzrayim, Kivar Acham, and so forth. And we're not going into all of that now. Just the basic idea, as you know, that Paro and his servants had a complete change of heart and decided to chase after the Jews. And they gathered a tremendous army and chariots and horses and so forth. And they chased after, take a look at Ches, Vayechazek Hashem a slave Paro, Melech Mitzrayim. And God hardened the heart of Paro, the king of Mitzrayim, Vayirdof, Acharei Bnei Yisrael. And he chased after the Bnei Yisrael. Uvnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Rama. And the Bnei Yisrael went out with a high hand. It's interesting. I mean, one can ask the question, what is the connection? Why is it mentioning that point over here, that they went out with a high hand? Rashi says, Bigvura gvoa, with a gvura, a certain power, a certain strength. Umufursemes, in public. I'm not sure if this is intended to create, so to speak, the contrast between the Jews, the state of mind that they were in when they left Egypt, and the state of mind that they're going to be in very quickly when they perceive that the Egyptians are chasing after them.
Rabbi.
The next pasuk is very crucial. It's pasuk Yud. Paro hikriv. And Paro drew close. And the Torah has a very strange way of presenting, of describing the perception of the Jews, that the Jews perceived this. You have to know how to analyze a pasuk. You have to stop, even though when you're reading it quickly, it doesn't seem to present the problem. It's just telling you the story. But there's no real need to say that the Jews lifted their eyes and they saw. I mean, we obviously, they chased after them. They came close. There's no need for the pasuk to stop and to get into this very literal or graphic type of description. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael eseinehem, that the b'nei Yisrael lifted their eyes. V'hinei Mitzrayim nosei achareihem, and behold, Egypt was chasing after them. Well, that's pretty obvious, of course. There's a point in describing it this way. Vayiru ma'od, and they were very afraid. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem, and they screamed out to God. Now we have that Rashi that says, Noseya achareihem, chasing after them. So the plain shot is, B'lev echad, with one heart, Ki'ish echad, as one man. Davar acher, another shot, V'hinei Mitzrayim Noseya achareihem, which says that Mitzrayim was chasing after them. Ra'u sar shel Mitzrayim, they saw the Tsar, the master of Mitzrayim. Noseya min ha-shamayim, traveling from the sky. Lazor le-Mitzrayim, to help, to assist Mitzrayim. And clearly, this is the cause. I mean, the Jews, the result of this was that the Jews went into some type of a panic. Today, the term today, I guess, would be like a meltdown. Because you see that they cried out to God, but this doesn't seem to be the appropriate, the correct type of tefillah. I'm not even sure if this crying really is to be regarded as tefillah. But in Pasuk Yud Aleph, you see the state of mind that they were in. Hayomer el Moshe, and they said to Moshe, Hamibli ein kvarim b'Mitzrayim. Are there no graves left in Egypt? Lekach tanu lomos b'midbar, that you took us out to die in the midbar. Mazos osisa lanu, what is this that you've done to us? Lo tzionu b'Mitzrayim, to take us out of Egypt. Halozeh adavar, isn't this what we said? Asher dibarnu alech b'Mitzrayim lemor, isn't this what we told you in Mitzrayim? Chadal mimenu v'navdas Mitzrayim, leave us alone and we'll serve. In Mitzrayim, ki tov lanu avodas Mitzrayim, mimusein b'midbar. Because we'd rather serve Mitzrayim rather than die in the wilderness. So apparently this is one of the complaints they lodged against Moshe, that they can live with the enslavement. If it's a choice between being enslaved to Egypt as opposed to dying in the wilderness, they preferred to be slaves. They didn't necessarily give me liberty or give me death. That's not what they're saying over here. So this seems to be a complete breakdown, turning against Moshe Rabbeinu, and obviously you can see the sense of total hopelessness. What happened to the confidence that they expressed when they said "Ein lanu ela divrei ben Amram"? Something occurred. That was not the same attitude, because Rashi says that was praiseworthy. Vayasu chayin, they listened to Moshe, and voluntarily went back into the position of danger. So apparently they weren't afraid. Well, they had confidence. Now, after seeing Mitzrayim chasing after them, they completely fall apart. So what happened? All of that is crucial to understanding Pasuk Yud Gimel, which is the result. where Moshe tells them, Hesiatzfu Re'u, Es Yeshua Hashem. Now, with regard to this particular midrash, Rabbi Chait gave pshat, and of course I'm going to give it over my own terms, my own understanding. I gave a shir on the subject in general. I didn't attach it to this particular Rashi, but I based it on the idea. And that is to say that all of the various nations that obtain great might and conquer and conquest, all the great empires, rule by virtue of establishing a certain type of a myth. And that's the myth of invincibility, the factor of intimidation. You see that, for example, most recently in the case of Nazi Germany. And that is that, aside from their actual strength, what they seek to do is to intimidate all type of opposition by creating the myth of being invincible. And it's very, very successful. Because once they're able to do that, then the various nations, other nations that otherwise perhaps could put up a resistance, they just crumble. And they were able to take over nations in a matter of days. Because once people fall prey to this myth, which is the deification of human might, it's not just the overestimation, but it reaches a certain point where it's deification, and they're viewed as, so to speak, a superman. That's, of course, what they believed in. They believed that they were the supermen, the superior race, and everything they did was an attempt to establish that myth. That basically is the idea of the Sar Shel Mitzrayim. It fits in, it flows from the Plame Shot. That is to say that the Pasuk is describing a change that the Jews experienced in terms of their attitude towards the Egyptians. Instead of looking at them realistically, and of course you have to look at your enemies realistically, but there's a complete difference when you recognize that this is only a human being. It's only human might, and human might is very, very limited, and there's no such thing as invincible, and every enemy has their weaknesses. Every enemy can be defeated, can be destroyed. Every empire in history, no matter how great it was, eventually was destroyed, because it's an impossibility that it doesn't have weaknesses, it doesn't make mistakes, and if a person is intelligent enough and is not overawed by the myth, then they will find the means of dealing with them. It's a completely different attitude. And, for example, you could see this with regard to David and Goliath, whereas others were overawed, and once you allow that emotion to take hold, and you can't deal with it in a realistic way, to David HaMelech, he was just another force. He had dealt with the lions, he had dealt with the bear, and he's saying it's the same thing. I wasn't overawed by a lion, and I wasn't overawed by a bear. I studied them. I understand their strengths, I understand their weaknesses, and the same thing over here. But this is what happened to the Jews. And we can understand this at this point in time. They're very vulnerable to this kind of thing, because there's other factors involved, and that is that they've been enslaved. There's always that danger. The slave always tends to ascribe supernatural power, so to speak, to the oppressor. And I also want to point out, if you study the history of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the Nazis had cleared out the Warsaw Ghetto, and there was only like a small remnant remained. Essentially, they were like the youths and teenagers, and they decided, they knew what they were headed for, so they decided to die fighting, to launch an uprising. And amazingly, they withstood the German army for longer than the entire nation of Poland, when Poland was invaded. And the Germans couldn't believe it, and they kept on sending reinforcements until to the point is they eventually had to like just bomb building after building after building. The Jews fought back so ferociously, and they exacted a tremendous toll from the Germans. If you read the accounts, you'll see that when they first started out, they didn't think they had any chance of achieving anything. It's just a question that they would prefer to die fighting. And the accounts describe that when the Germans first came in, they thought it'd be nothing. It'd be a cakewalk. They'd just walk over them in no time. And in one of the first battles, when they took their Molotov cocktails and they threw it inside of a tank, and they saw the Germans jumping out and screaming in horror, so that had a tremendous liberating effect upon them. Because they couldn't believe that these were the supermen. These were supposed to be people that were powerful and brave, and they saw them like cowering and crying and screaming like ordinary people. So the entire myth, that entire myth of having supernatural types of powers was destroyed. They saw them as just being weak, ordinary human beings, and that's what gave them the power to keep fighting. Now, to proceed further, every nation, when it goes to war, has to deal with this kind of an issue. That is, on the one hand, they try and intimidate the other nation, the one they're fighting against, by getting them to believe in this, that they're invulnerable. Now, generally, the response, when you're confronted with that, so the military commanders, so what do they seek to do? They seek to counter that by using the same mechanism to build up your sense of confidence. That's what you see this in sports as well. On every level, you see this type of phenomenon, this intimidation factor, to try and create that impression of being invulnerable, invincible. Now, the way people counter that is to try and build up your ego. You're the one that partakes of that characteristic. But the methodology of Yahadis is completely different. We don't believe that this has any validity whatsoever. And the real solution to this problem is to negate the entire concept, the overestimation of man, by the realization that the only real source of a victory and strength and the ultimate reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the concept of Hashemish Mulchama. That's really what took place in Kriyas Yamsuf. They saw the Mitzrayim completely in a state of utter destruction, and the entire myth of invincibility. Chazal say the way they were shaking up and down, and the way they were screaming and everything. That entire myth of invincibility was completely destroyed by a recognition of the fact that no, everything is under the control of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why when the Jewish nation goes out to war, so the Kohanim address them and bring up this point that you shouldn't be afraid of them. They're going to make all these gestures, these noises, and the stomping of the foot of the horses, all of these different things to try and create that invincibility. And no, you have to remember that Hashem is fighting with you. That as long as you're in line with the will of Hashem and Hashem is on your side, that's the only source of strength, and everything else is a myth. And it's only that realization. It's not, the attempt is not to pump them up and to give them that feeling, to transfer that feeling from the enemy to you. No, you're the one that really is great. It's not through an attempt to partake of the nonsensical idea of human greatness, but to the contrary, the recognition that there is no such thing as human greatness, and the entire thing is a myth, because the ultimate reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and success is based upon being in line with the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that's what happened over here, and that's how the Midrash fits in with the Plaim Shot, that they saw the Tsar of Mitzrayim. The Tsar of Mitzrayim means this type of a myth, this human image, this deification of the human image, flying out of the sky, so to speak. Once that is describing that process, that they projected this supernatural type of a power onto them. And once that happened, then they completely fell apart. And They just cried out to God. Now, it seems to me that this was not a appropriate type of a tefillah, because if it was, then it wouldn't be followed up by this bitter complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu. Because in the next pasuk, they seem to be negating and denying everything, that they're just going to get killed. So they've lost their complete conviction that everything that happened was a result of God's will for the things to be. Because they're saying it's a disaster here. We're going to get killed. That's because they had fallen prey to this emotion. But Moshe tells them, see, in this situation is unique. Because at this point in time, in a sense, the Jews had not really become liberated. It's interesting that Rashi points out that the place is Pi Hahiros. It was named Pi Hahiros. That was sort of like a pass between two mountains. And Rashi says it's called Hiros because the word Hiros is related to Cheros, because that's where they became free. Which on the surface is a bit strange, because it seems they became free when they left Mitzrayim. But it seems to me that they didn't really become free until Kriyas Yamsuf, because they had not freed themselves of this tendency towards the overestimation, or if you want to use the term deification, the projection of supernatural powers onto the might of the Egyptians. So therefore they were simply incapable at that point in time of standing up and fighting. That's what the pasuk says. Vayomer Moshe la'am al tiro. Here the instruction was different. Don't be afraid. His yatzfu uru, as Yeshua said Hashem. But there's something you have to do. You can't just fall apart completely. You're exempted from the need to stand up and fight. That we understand you can't do at this point. But you have a chiyuv of his yatzfu uru, as Yeshua said Hashem. You will see the Yeshua said Hashem. You will see that the real Yeshua comes from God. See, there's no attempt made to pump them up. And no, don't, you guys can do it, and you guys are the ones that have the power, nothing like that. But if you'll be able to control yourself, essentially what he's telling them to do is to control your emotions. And that's V'yatem Tacharishon, basically. V'yatem Tacharishon means to be quiet. The Ebenezer says, Hepuch Vayitzaku B'nei Yisrael. Tacharishon means is addressing itself to Vayitzaku. Opposite. The opposite of Vayitzaku. Stop your screaming out. Which would indicate that screaming out was just an expression of their panic. So they're being commanded to gain control of that panic. If you can't gain control of that, there's nothing can be done for you. Nothing happens magically. Whatever God is doing demands something from a person. Even if the person can't fight, so then the person has to take cognizance, has to learn the lesson of what's happening over here. And that's what it says. Ki asher isem es Mitzrayim hayom. Take note. Take note. You're seeing Mitzrayim hayom. And the way you're seeing him today, they appear to be invincible. And there's nothing that can be done to stop them. Lo so sifun. Right, remember that and learn the true lesson of that. That's meaningless and they're soon to be wiped out. Remember that state. Remember that emotion. Remember what you saw. And you believed what you saw, it created a certain emotion, and you ascribed truth to that emotion, and then you saw within a short period of time that was absolutely had no connection to the reality, because they were completely destroyed. Remember that lesson. Hashem Yilochim Lachem, V'atem Tacharishon. It's interesting that that's also V'atem Tacharishon. Because why does it have to say V'atem Tacharishon? Hashem Yilochim Lachem. That's what the Ebenezer says. That you've got to stop that screaming. It means you have to gain complete control over yourself and be prepared to absorb and learn the lessons of what's happening, of what you're going to witness. All right, and then of course, it proceeds to a description of everything which culminates in the Kriyas Yamsuf. But according to this, I think we can answer the questions. That this miracle was different than the other miracles. Indeed, as Rashi points out, this is where they obtained their real freedom. Of course, all of the tefillos are filled with this one theme, that al tiftachu b'nedivim, that the biggest obstacle towards the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the overestimation of man. A person is always searching for that. The powerful person puts his faith in him, puts his security in him. That's why the tefillah says that you're not allowed to go and visit a person before you dive into Hashem in the morning. And if he does, it's like Bama. Yeah, play on words. Bamehu Nechshav, Bama. That he's erecting an altar. because this is a very powerful emotion. And the Torah says, "Al tiftachu b'nedivim v'ven adam she'ein lo seshua." The a person has to free himself from that type of an attitude to ascribe power, any significant kind of power, to people. Of course, you have to know how to use people. There are people in a position, and one has to be able to deal with them, and so on and so forth. But that's a practical thing. And the tefillos of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, always that contrast between Melech Elyon aval Melech Evyon. It's always comparing the ultimate king to the human king. And the reason for that is, to the extent that people are subservient to this concept of human might, that is the biggest obstacle to a recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why this miracle had a completely different effect. It freed them. It freed the Jews from subservience to the idea of human might. And as long as they were subjected to that, it was a tremendous obstacle in terms of their recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and in terms of their ability to function as Klal Yisrael. That's why they sang Shira. And the whole idea of the Shira is not the glorification of war at all, but it's the glorification of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ki ga'o ga'o, that God is the one who's great. And then Rashi says, over and above the people who try to magnify themselves. Now, the only greatness is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we recognize that all the attempts of man to glorify himself is all false. Zekeli v'anvehu. And so on and so forth. Hashem ish melchama. God is the ultimate power. But not for the glorification of war. The description of everything that happened to the Mitzrayim, Amar Oyev Erdov Asik, that's to bring up all of these factors. That is to review that the enemy tries to create this attitude that he's supreme, that he's invincible. And that's part of the Shira. In order to recognize the greatness of the miracle, you have to be cognizant of the state that existed before it. And the enemy feels this tremendous glory and power and so forth. And then to the contrast, like nothing, to the bottom of the ocean, like he has absolutely no power whatsoever. He's like a puppet. That realization is what liberated them. And that's why they sang the Shira. And that, I think, will connect us to what takes place at the end of the Parsha. It's interesting. The Parsha Samolek takes place at the end of this Parsha, because there's a connection between the two. It's only a matter of weeks. It's before Matan Torah. And Matan Torah was 3 months after they left. Excuse me, Matan Torah was 49 days after they left, 7 weeks after they left Mitzrayim. So this is less than 7 weeks. It's difficult to understand how they were able to transform themselves into a fighting force in such a short amount of time. From a group that had fallen apart completely, and Moshe had to tell them, "Hisyatzfu Ru'u as Yeshua Sarashem." And now Moshe tells Yeshua, "B'chal Adam Hashem, choose men and go out and fight." What took place? So it seems to me that what took place was simply, once they had overcome, once they had freed themselves from this enslavement to the idea of human might, and they recognized that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then they were able to fight. And of course, you can it provides an avenue for understanding the hands of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, Moshe was responsible for them, and when they looked at Moshe Rabbeinu and they subordinated their hearts, Rashi says, to their Father in heaven, when this realization took hold of them, that gave them strength. And when they were not focused on that, and they were subjected to the idea of human might and the fear of human might, so then they were weaker. Then the Amalek gained the upper hand. But the basic idea, of course, is that we're obligated to fight for ourselves. That's part of our perfection. And the perfection is not just that we stand up for ourselves and we fight for ourselves, but when we fight, it's really a manifestation of Kiddush Hashem, that the source of courage derives from our realization that we're fighting, actually what we're fighting against is the exaltation of human beings. We're fighting against the overestimation of man, the deification of man, and proclaiming the idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's why the Mishka, the Aaron would go out with them to battle and so forth. I mean, that's really the source of our strength. The source of our strength is the recognition that everything is in the hands of God, and success in terms of the human framework depends upon being in line with the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. With regard to the question of the Malachi Asharis, that they were rebuked, I would say that our minhag, by the way, is that on the first day of Pesach, on the first 2 days in Chutz La'aretz, so we say the whole Hallel. Then the rest of the time we say the half Hallel, so to speak, to sort of incorporate this idea that you can't say the whole Hallel because Masa Yodai Tovim Bayom. I would say that there are two aspects. From the standpoint of human existence, you have the phenomenon of Rishayim. And as long as Rishayim exists, so the purpose, God's purpose in creation is not fulfilled. So the destruction of the wicked, Bavod Rishayim Rina, Chazal say, that the destruction of the wicked is a good thing, a cause for rejoicing. So, obviously, you have to give praise for that. And that's the whole idea of Shira. That's much of human history is a struggle against the forces of evil, to destroy evil, whose objective is to negate the whole idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So, certainly, when evil people are defeated, that's a cause for rejoicing. And the rejoicing should be because of the sake of heaven, L'shem Shemayim, not for personal ego reasons. The idea of the Malachi Asharis, however, in my opinion, it's different because the Malachi Asharis are from a different framework. We're humans, and we have to exist within this framework. We have to live within the framework of the human reality, the social reality. And therefore, we have to engage in this battle against evil. However, the Malachi Asharis represent a different approach. That is to say, from a different standpoint, there is a tragic element over here, because these Egyptians were also the work of God's hand. And it's God's will that they too should have lived correctly. They should have found the correct path. And the fact that they didn't do so and they became Rishayim is a tragedy, because God's will was not fulfilled with regard to them. So that's the idea that God rebukes the Malachi Asharis. So it means to say that, so to speak, that it's one thing for the Jews. It's one thing for people who are living within this framework. We have to operate within an imperfect framework. And within an imperfect framework, the removal of the flaws, the correction of mistakes, is a good thing. Yeah, but from the different standpoint, from the metaphysical standpoint, if you can consider all the factors, that there's also an element of tragedy over here. So I would say that that's why we really do both. That we have to sing Shira, because that's our framework. But at the same time, we say half Hallel because we also should be cognizant of this idea. We should also be cognizant that from a different standpoint, our Avas Hashem demands that we recognize that there's an element of tragedy over here too. That the fact that there are Rishayim, and there are people who don't fulfill their purpose, and to the contrary, go to the exact opposite, that is an element of tragedy. That's how I think you resolve both of those ideas.